My fate as writer of Barney Thompson novels was sealed during my first visit to see my new editor at Piacus after we'd signed the contract for them to publish The Long Midnight of Barney Thompson. We'd signed a standard two-book deal, with details of the second book left blank and up for discussion. I'd already written the first T.S. Hutton novel, which wouldn't be published for a further 14 years, and ran that by them. But it was rough, nothing at all like the Barney, and looking back, the synopsis I wrote was terrible. They didn't get beyond the first three chapters. I arrived for that first meeting with no real idea of what I was going to do other than this vague notion of writing a second Barney and having him hide out in a monastery. That was my fallback option, on the off chance I didn't think of anything brilliant in the plane on the way to London. Inevitably, I didn't think of anything brilliant, so I mentioned the possibility of Barney too. My editor perked up like Scooby-Doo at the mention of snacks. It was settled, and that was me doomed to write Barney Thompson novels for the next 10 years. My original title for the book was The Barber Surgeon's Hairshirt, which had also been my original title for the first book. Piacus didn't like The Barber Surgeon's Hairshirt. They asked me to come up with another name that involved both Barney Thompson and haircutting. I sent them a list, I don't recall any of the others, and remembered including the cutting edge of Barney Thompson and thinking, I shouldn't do that because this is the one they'll choose and I don't like it. And that was the one they chose. When the dust had settled in the Piacus years and they'd cancelled the series and given the rights back, and I was publishing the book myself on Kindle, and then when it was taken over by Blast Teeth, I changed the title back to The Barber Surgeon's Hairshirt. Not that that had any effect on anything, anywhere. Then when Blast Teeth folded and I once again took to publishing the books myself on Kindle, I changed the title back to The Cutting Edge. Should really just have left it that way all the way through. I don't suppose it really amounts to Hill of Beans, but I suppose it may have confused someone briefly somewhere along the way. And now here we are, book two in the Barney series. Barney's misdeeds from book one have been uncovered and our hero has gone on the run, pursued by two police officers. At the time of writing, my favourite new show, Northern Exposure, had just finished, and lamenting that as I was, I based my two police officers on Joel and Maggie and one of the monks on Chris in the Morning, something that might well be apparent to the very limited Venn diagram intersection of followers of both Barney and Sicily, Alaska. It's also apparent that just prior to writing the book, I've been given both a thesaurus and an Oxford Book of Quotations for Christmas. I hopefully use these to comic effect, but let's not get carried away. Fellow Earthlings, The Cutting Edge of Barney Thompson. Forasmuch as it hath pleased Almighty God of his great mercy to take unto himself the soul of our dear brother here departed, we therefore commit his body to the ground, earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, in sure and certain hope of the resurrection to eternal life. Words hung in the cold air, then disappeared in the mist which evaporated before the abbot. The monks, slightly over 30 in number, watched the hard dirt bounce on the lid of Brother Saturday's coffin before settling with a cold finality. Three deep around the grave they stood, heads bowed in solemn prayer and sorrow, all but one. Edward, Ash, Matthew, Jerusalem, Joshua, Pond Life, Ezekiel, Mince, Festus, and so on around the grave they stood. Lost in sadness, unaware that many more of them would die and that Festus's upcoming gargoyle on the head would be but one death among a great legion of others. Been nearly 11 years since they'd lost one of their number to that fell sergeant, Death. Mammon, the evil succubus of fornication, and the lure of a comfortable life had taken their toll in that time, but not Death, not since Brother Alexander had fallen from the escarpment around the third floor of the abbey. The abbot opened his eyes from one last silent prayer, and then, head low, began the short walk back down the hill to the shelter and slender warmth of the monastery. Two steps behind, an ecclesiastical refugee from the Secret Service, Brother Herman, brown hood drawn up around his head, sunken eyes watching the abbot's back, long white face. Hooked nose, the beak of some deranged bird of prey, Brother Herman suspected everyone. Whoever that was who'd plunged the knife into the neck of Brother Saturday, who'd held it there while Saturday had wriggled and squirmed away his final seconds, who'd watched the blood flow along the corridor and down the weeping steps, must not now be allowed access to the abbot. None shall pass, thought Brother Herman. As their feet crunched into the frosted snow, the remainder of the assembly stared into the grave. thoughts of death and murder and God and resurrection and everlasting life. A test of faith. At a time like this, how many of them truly believed? The snow-covered hills rose around them, reaching to a blue sky pale in the anemic light of dawn, and over the hills in the middle distance, the bitter sea washed upon a barren winter shore. One by one, they paid their last respects and headed off slowly back to the austere grey building that was their home. Breakfast awaited. Two remained behind, burdened with shoveling the hardened dirt over Saturday's coffin. Pale brown wood, soon to be home to God's final act of desecration upon the human body. They stood with spades at the ready, waiting for the others to return to the monastery before beginning their task, the last kick of the ball in the football match of Saturday's life. The younger man, his face unfolded, thoughts elsewhere. His lips betrayed a knowing smile, an acceptance of fate. What would be done was done. Tonsured head, hair a little long at the back, could do with a cut, thought the other man. Older, face creased with worry, full head of hair, greying with years. The last monk disappeared from view. They glanced at one another. It was time. The younger one dug his shovel into the waiting pile of dirt. The older man took a look around him. The path leading from the graveyard to the monastery, the surrounding forest, trees white with snow, the low hills which dimmed the monastery to the pit of the glen in the bitter wind which howled through the distant edge of the freezing waters of Loch Hope, then bent his knee and thrust his shovel into the dirt. Already their hands were numb with cold, yet aching with an insistent pain. Brother Stephen shoveled the dirt without emotion, knowing not the burden of his work. He was content to do as he was bid, even though, being neither the newest monk nor the youngest, he should not have been called upon to perform the task of the gravedigger. For this he had his unquiet tongue to thank. He glanced at the older man who was performing his task with grim determination. Not for Brother Stephen to know that this man, the latest addition to their complement, had become used to death in all its iniquitous guises. "So what brings you here, Brother Jacob?" he asked the older man, continuing to shovel dirt slowly and monotonously. Barney Thompson, barber, hesitated. A man in the run, a man with a dark past, secrets to hide, he shoveled. "Not sure," he replied eventually. "Just needing something different, you know." Brother Stephen nodded, tossed another pile of dirt into the grave. The top of the coffin was now completely obscured. Brother Saturday was gone. "Got you," he said. "It's that whole vicissitude thing, the basic need for something new. We all feel it. It's like Heraclitus says, everything flows and nothing stays. You can't step twice in the same river. That's why I'm here." Barney stared, Stephen shoveled, knowing smile on cold blue lips. "Aye," said Barney. "Right." Barney had never heard of Heraclitus, wondered if he'd played centre forward for some Greek football team. I doubted it. He had to accept he'd come to a new world after 20 comfortable years in the barber shop. Not all conversations would be about football. "So what are you running from, Brother Jacob?" Stephen rested on his shovel, looked through the mist which had formed from his words. Barney felt the beating of his heart, but realised that Stephen could not possibly know his secrets. None of these monks could know. He tried to sound casual. "Life," he said. Stephen laughed and began once again the slow and steady movement of his spade. Barney wondered if he'd said something funny. "Life, eh?" said Stephen, shaking his head. "Oh, aye. That thing we do." Barney felt uncomfortable, a hand on his shoulder. Before he began to shovel, he saw a bird of prey in the distance, hovering, searching the snow-covered ground for breakfast. The sparrowhawk fancied some bacon and lightly scrambled egg, but accepted he'd probably have to settle for the vole or the mouse, if he was lucky. Could be an eagle, thought Barney, for he didn't know birds of prey. "But the thing about life," said Stephen from behind his shovel, "is that no matter how far you run, my friend, there's no getting away from it." Brother Stephen tossed dirt with methodical abandon. Barney Thompson stared into the grave. Barney felt at home, a pair of scissors in his right hand, a comb in his left, a cutthroat razor at his side, no other tools with which to work. Barbary at its most coarse, unfettered by electric razors or blow dryers or artificial lights, no cape around the victim to squeeze the neck and protect the virgin body from follicular contamination. Barbary as it must have been practiced in olden days when men were men and the earth was flat. Raw, stone age barbary, where every snip of the scissors was done by instinct, where every cut was a potential disaster, every clip a walk along a tightrope of calamity, if they hew a cleave into the kernel of the collective human id. Barbary without a safety net. Barbary to put fear into the breast of the bravest knight and to quail the heart of the stoutest king. A duel with the Satan of pre-modernism, where artistry became strength and genius the episcopacy of fate. Total barbary. Naked. Bloody. Stripped of artifice. Apparently Jesus was a short arse, said Barney, carefree around the left ear, forgetting where he was, to whom he was talking. Brother Ezekiel raised an eyebrow. Barney was revelling in the primitive conditions, and one afternoon he'd reeled off a Sean Connery, name of the rose, a Christian Slater, name of the rose, an F. Murray Abraham, name of the rose, and a Ron Perlman, name of the rose, as well as the abbot's brother Cadfell. No cash, no tips, just quiet words of praise and heartfelt thanks for doing the Lord's work. 4'6", we a hunchback. Brother Ezekiel coughed portentously into the back of his hand. You're forgetting where you are, Brother Jacob. Barney stopped, scissors poised. He thought about it and said, oh shit, aye. Brother Ezekiel closed his eyes in silent prayer for the errant monk, despising the Lord, swearing. You could always tell a new recruit. Barney lapsed into silence. He ran the comb through the hair, clicked the scissors. The light from outside was beginning to fade and he was glad of the three candles which flickered in the small shelf. He was supposed to be keeping his head down and his mouth shut. His language wasn't too bad, not by Glasgow standards, but it was still unnecessarily unsavoury for within the monastery walls. He'd been doing fine, head down, only speaking when spoken to, like any new recruit in any walk of life. Don't make a noise until you had your feet under the table. However, a couple of hours of barbary had been his undoing. He'd been all right during the Sean Connery and the Abbot's Cadfell. Finding his feet, getting back into the groove, reacquainting himself with his scissors fingers. However, 10 minutes into the Christian Slater, Brother Sledge had made an innocent remark about the weather, and Barney had been unleashed, his mouth running ahead of him like a leopard on amphetamines. And so he covered all the great topics of the day, the profligacy of that year's December snow, the situation in Gorno-Karabakh. Apparently Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings in a fortnight. 15 reasons why Beethoven wasn't as deaf as he liked to make out. 6 kings of Scotland who were circumcised at the age of 50. How Sid James nearly beat Giscard d'Estaing to the French presidency in 1974. Why Kennedy only won the US presidency because he kept J. Edgar Hoover supplied with edible underwear. Errol Flynn was a woman. Apparently Jesus was a short horse. Barney had been full of it. Total inexorable bollocks. He'd been at the peak of his form, talking the sort of crap of which most guys with 15 pints in them could only dream. The monks had sat and listened, smiling occasionally, nodding sagely at the appropriate moments, moments when Barney had not necessarily been expecting them to nod. For they'd all seen it before. The new monk, unfamiliar with the conventions and truths of monastic life, whose tongue would not be still. Every now and again one of these types might survive the rigours of the austere existence, but usually they would last no longer than a snowman in the Sahara. Few within the walls were prepared to put their money on Brother Jacob lasting longer than a few weeks, even if any of them had possessed money and if the abbot had not closed down the tote operated by Brother Stephen. For now, however, following Ezekiel's admonishment, Barney snipped quietly, kept his mouth shut, his thoughts to himself, tried to think of everything else he had said that afternoon, wondering if he'd strayed beyond the boundaries of discretion, words which had been allowed to pass but which had not gone unnoticed. Couldn't remember. He thought of goldfish. Brother Ezekiel stared at the wall. There's no mirrors here. His thoughts, like those of many of his colleagues, were still consumed by the unfortunate demise of Brother Saturday and by futile speculation on who might have perpetrated the crime. Ezekiel was among those who believed that the abbot should call on the outside agencies of the law, but the abbot's word must be respected. If he had faith in the ability of Brother Herman to get to the bottom of the murky river of truth, then so should the rest of the monks. But what of Herman was not so above suspicion as everyone thought. Ezekiel's brow furrowed. He made a mental note not to voice that doubt to anyone. The door swung open behind them. The cold air rushed in. Barney shivered and turned, remembered to stop cutting as he did so. How many times in the old days, before his renaissance of the previous March, had he forgotten that fundamental law and inadvertently swiped off an ear? Time for one more, asked Brother Stephen, closing the door behind him. I heard you're only doing this barber gig twice a week. Barney looked down at the tonsured head of Brother Ezekiel. Dome shaved to perfection, back of the head cut with Germanic precision. In fact, the haircut was finished. He realised the only reason he'd still been cutting was they hadn't wanted it to end. When he was done here, he'd be required to spend an hour or two in religious contemplation, to commune with God. "I fine," he said. "Come on in. I'm done, in fact." He lifted the towel from around Ezekiel's neck, shook the detritus of the cut onto the floor, stepped back, allowed Ezekiel to stand. Ezekiel ran his fingers along the back of his neck, was impressed with the lack of hair having worked its way down to irritate and annoy. "Thank you very much, brother. A good haircut, I believe," he said. Oh, they could not possibly know. "Your hands must have been guided by God." Barney smiled, thinking, "Bugger off. God had nothing to do with it, mate." He knew he shouldn't be having such thoughts. "Goodbye, brother," he said instead. Ezekiel took his leave, off in search of a mirror, knowing of at least two of the monks who kept one hidden beneath a pillow. Brother Stephen took his seat. He turned, giving Barney an encouraging look. "Heard you doing some fine work, brother," he said. Barney said nothing, but felt pleased nonetheless. "They're saying in the kitchens that if Marlon Brando had cut Martin Sheen's hair in Apocalypse Now, this is how he would have done it, cutting hair like a god." Barney shrugged, placed the towel around Stephen's shoulders. "It's nothing, just my job." Stephen nodded, knowing exactly from where Barney came. "Well, it'd be then," asked Barney. Presumed it was going to be another Name of the Rose job, although he did wonder how many of them had actually ever seen Name of the Rose, or Brother Cadfell for that matter. Stephen ran his hand across his chin. "I think I'll go for a Mike McShane Robin Hood Prince of Thieves. What do you think? Think that'll suit me?" Barney stared at the top of Stephen's head. He had never heard of Mike McShane. He presumed correctly that it couldn't be too different from any other haircut he'd given that day. "Perfect," he said. "Great. I'll go for that then." Stephen settled back, a look of satisfied contentment on his chops. The look of someone who knew that life was a bowl of curried lamb keek, but who was quite content with the fact that one with his own and others' foibles. Barney lifted his comb and scissors and set about his business. A contented customer and a contented barber. The perfect combination. He was about to launch into discussion of the casuistic fundamentals of Morton's Fork, when he remembered his earlier edict to keep his thoughts to himself. So he stuck to his business as the light faded and the candles flickered. Brother Stephen's tongue could never be still, however. Incensed with indignation, Satan stood unterrified, and like a comet burned at fires the length of a fakir's huge in the Arctic sky, of whom his horrid hair shakes pestilence and war, said Brother Stephen. Let the words mingle with the flickering shadows in the dim orange light. Aye, right, said Barney. He paused. No reason for not talking now, he was being invited. What was that exactly? Milton, said Brother Stephen. I always dug that line about hair, you know, shaking out pestilence and war. You must have seen some hair like that in your time, eh? Barney nodded, wondering what to say, as out of his depth as he used to be when discussing football. Aye, he said. I've seen some amount of shite come out of hair, right enough. Ach, shit, sorry, I did again. Oh, bugger. There I go. I mean, no problem, Jacob. I know where you're coming from. It's not easy coming here. Got the same problems myself. You think the abbot wants to hear his monks quoting Milton? Not a chance. Swearing in its own way, too. You just got to come to terms with the new way of life. But don't sweat it, my friend. We've all been there. I shall sleep and move with the moving ships. Change is the wind, change. Veer in the tide. That's what I always say. Aye, very good, said Barney. I'll do that then, eh? He lapsed into silence. Considered that sometimes silence was best. Brother Stephen, however, was a talker. So you know what they're doing with all the hair clippings, Jacob? Put them out, I suppose, said Barney. Stephen shook his head. Barney narrowly avoided penetrating deep into the flesh of his neck with the icy steel of the scissors. Barber accidentally murders new best friend, God miffed, thought Barney. Yet I knew that any headline he saw himself in would not be anything like as overwrought as the one or two he'd seen from the real press before dropping out of life. Barber surgeon ate my cat, claims housewife. Killer barber on run eats human flesh. Depraved sex secrets of barber pervert. Oh, aye, said Barney. What is it I do with them, then? This is a poor place, brother, as you'll have seen. We need to use everything we can get our hands on. There's very little which is not recycled. The hair that's cut from our heads will go into the making of pillows and cushions. The whole comfort bag. It's that what goes around comes around kind of a thing. I know some of them think it's a bit out there, but I like it. I mean, the traditionalists, Brother Herman and all that lot, well, they're peeing in their cloaks about it. You can't worship God without suffering, all that rubbish. But you know, I always think that God must enjoy his little comforts too. There's got to be some nights when the big fella just kicks off his Air Jordans, sticks his feet in the table, downs a couple of cold ones, switches on the TV and gets a few angel babes snuggle up to his beard. You know what I'm saying? Barney continued snipping quietly at the back of Brother Stephen's neck. This just wasn't the same as discussing theology with his mate Bill Taylor over a couple of pints in the pub. You mean that's the kind of thing that goes on here? You're kidding me, Jacob, said Stephen, smiling. Of course not. We're talking pillows here, not 57 channels of satellite TV and a six-pack of Bud. But the Abbott knows how to do it. Just the odd comfort here and there to keep the natives happy. That's all it takes. Of course, there's a lot more they could do. But you can't go too far, eh? We're monks, after all. Aye, said Barney, fair enough. But then, of course, there's the yin-yang business, the whole enigma of good, bad, dark, light, positive, negative, all of that. The Abbott allows us the comfort of pillows and cushions, but at the same time, you've got to keep the product of your hirsutery so that Brother Herman can use it for making hair shirts. Equal and opposites, that whole thing. Pain, pleasure, you know? Hair shirts? Asked Barney, pausing mid-cut. Hair shirts. It's a medieval thing, yet still relevant in today's monastery. It's what your modern penitent monk likes to wear. Aye, right, said Barney, totally lost. You know, when you've committed a sin, you get a shirt made so that all the hairs are prickly on the inside, really jaggedy-arsed. It's a pain in the backside. Brother Herman loves the damn things. Well, he loves getting the other monks into them the minute he has an opportunity. Just wait till you see him with the scent of blood in that long, thin nose of his. On how serious the sin depends just how long you get to wear the shirt. Do your penance. Barney's eyes were opened. He'd never heard of the hair shirt before. I thought it a good idea, except if the abbot found out about his past, he was going to have to wear his hair shirt for the next 3 or 4 centuries. So who makes them? He asked, getting his mind away from his guilt to which he'd begun to stray. Brother Herman himself, mad as they come, that's what I think. Wouldn't be surprised to find he sticks razor blades in there sometimes. You've worn one? Brother Stephen smiled. My friend, he makes them specifically so they'll fit me. I'm his best customer. Oh. Barney snipped away, doing a fine job around the back of the neck, distracted yet nevertheless performing with consummate ease and control. Brother Stephen's neck had never been in safer hands, but Barney could already feel the hair shirt around him. Not the worst punishment on the planet, surely, but it was to be worn day after day for a long time, and his sins were most definitely merited a long time. Then it would indeed be hell. He began to wonder if he should leave before Brother Herman got the chance to indict him for something. Well, you know, I can live with it. Learn to. Anyway, he hasn't got me for a couple of months, not since he caught me taking a quick suck and a smoke out in the forest one day. I swear he's got cameras out there, watching. Barney stood back. The scissor work was finished. Now for the more delicate razor operations. His hand was steady. That's it, Jacob. Cameras. I'd bet on it. He smiled and relaxed. If he hadn't closed down my betting operation, that is. Barney Thompson huddled in his corner in the attic, extra clothes retrieved, food in his stomach, fortified for the rest of the long night and another bitter day ahead when he'd have to stay out of sight of the rest of the monks. He was glad they hadn't told Brother Stephen his whereabouts, but also pleased he'd been to see him. He felt he had at least one friend in the world. And so Brother Ash was also dead, 4 down, 28 to go. He wondered if the killer would aim to do away with the full complement of monks one by one until there were only 2 of them left, both denying everything. But Brother Stephen was right. Any further deaths would be blamed upon him. The only thing for them now, if the weather was to prevent his escape from this place, was to find the murderer himself. Only then would it be possible for him to have his reprieve. Only then would he be able to prevent the police from turning up in their hundreds. Barney Thompson was a man with a mission. He didn't know the full weight of accusation against him. He only knew that he must do everything to clear his name. He wasn't guilty of any of the monastery murders, so he must prove himself innocent. Something he could only do by turning in the real killer. That's what he must discover. Then he could hand him over to the abbot and the police and at the same time turn himself in. That was his latest decision after more time in the black of night. Then he could stand trial for the crimes of the past, for another hour of lonely reflection in the darkened attic giving him hope. He persuaded himself. He'd been a spin doctor to his doubts on behalf of his earlier deeds. He could hand himself in to the police and get a good lawyer. What exactly had he been guilty of? Murder, certainly, but accidental murder, no more than manslaughter, not be any dangerous or foolish act of his own. Willie had slipped into a pair of scissors he'd been holding. Chris had fallen and cracked his head during the course of a minor stramash of which Chris himself had been the instigator. Disposing of the bodies instead of informing the police had obviously been a mistake, but perhaps it could be forgiven. As for disposing of the bodies of his mother's victims, surely any jury would understand that act. Could anyone stand to see their own mother vilified as a serial human butcher? Virtually all his actions had been those of a desperate and panicked man, horrible perhaps, but also understandable. That was what he persuaded himself. So he'd a plan. Find the monastery murderer and turn him into the abbot so that when the police arrived, he could hand himself over to them with at least a decent reference from the man of God. There was nothing he believed he couldn't prove himself innocent of. Of course, he hadn't seen the following morning's selection of newspaper headlines. The Sun, Thompson slaughters 98 women in terror week. The Times, Sadat assassination, Thompson accused. The Star, barber surgeon on kidnap spree. The Guardian, Barney Thompson quits Tories. The Daily Record, how barber surgeon made Gorham let in 5 against Portugal in 93. The Scotsman, uproar as boffins set to clone barber surgeon. The Herald, wave of naked bank robberies pinned on Thompson. The Express, Thompson kills 17 more. The Mirror, cool killer in Downing Street invite mystery. The Mail, Barney Thompson worn my daughter's skin, claims upset mum. The Aberdeen Press and Journal, northeast man goes to dentist. He would have to be quick and discreet. He would have to use the sum of all his investigative powers and intuition. He'd need to cut a swathe through the confusion, the deceit and the treachery. He would have to become all that he had run from. The prey would become the predator. He'd need to be a leopard, ready to pounce upon the wounded wildebeest of the truth. A lion, poised to plunge his jaws of revelation into the warm flesh of veracity. A panther, suspended on the doorstep of betrayal, the slashed and gouged hyena, abject prey to the incisor of integrity. A behemoth, hovering at the graveyard of inevitability, the cruel fangs of rectitude and probity, a brutal witch-smeller pursuing to the calumnious obloquy of injustice. A wolf, slavering at the tombstone of fealty, vengeful vitriolic teeth plunging brutally into the blackened, wasted heart of the little red riding hood of vituperative denigration. He would have to be savage, cunning, astute and shrewd. He'd need to mix the deviousness of Machiavelli with the guile of Sherlock Holmes, the vigour of Samson with the finesse of Rinaldo. He'd need to scale the peaks of intellect, while at the same time abrade the depths of artifice. This would need to be Barney Thompson's finest hour. Well, I'm fucked, he muttered to himself. He closed his eyes and let his head fall into his chest in an almost comfortable position. And soon sleep came to take him away to a world which is even darker and colder, a world inhabited solely by killers and their victims.